Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Bede Haynes, and welcome to another episode of the Australian and New Zealand Studies channel on the New Books Network. This afternoon, we have the author of Missing Among Us, Erin Stewart, who is joining us from Canberra, and her book has been published in 2021 by New South Books. Before I ask Erin to say hello, I'd just like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that I'm on, and pay my respects to the people past, present, and future. So good afternoon, Erin. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, no worries.
I would like to begin by letting the audience know a little bit about you. You're based in Canberra. You're a freelance writer. You've written for a number of publications, including the ABC, SBS, Daily Life, The Age. You also make regular radio appearances, and you have a PhD in nonfiction writing from the University of Wollongong, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, could you let us know how this book came about?
Yeah, so it was a pretty long process. So I started my PhD in 2014 in nonfiction writing. One of the things I was really interested in was how to tell stories that don't have an ending. I've been, you know, going to writing workshops and this sort of thing my whole life. And one of the things that, you know, you're told as an emerging writer is that, you know, all stories have to have a beginning, middle, and end, or like a clear like conflict and resolution. And what I was finding in my own life, but as well as other people's lives, that doesn't really happen. But it's still really important, even without a sense of resolution, to tell stories so that people understand what different experiences are like, and you can bring attention to really important issues. So that was kind of where I started. And then it kind of led pretty naturally to stories about missing persons, where there's quite a lot of unresolved stories, as well as people having to come to terms with quite ambiguous circumstances and maybe not really feeling like their story has an ending, but still feeling like it's really important for the story to be told.
Right. Now, when I read your book, Erin, what struck me, and it almost stays like a meditation throughout the whole book, is the first sentence where it says, "To be missing, you must be missed," which I think encapsulates a lot of what the book's about. And a couple of things I'd like you to reflect on there are that actual idea that being missing can be focused on not from the person who is missing, but the people who are looking for that person or the people who missed that person. Could you comment on that for me, please?
Yeah, sure. So I think one thing to keep in mind is that often people who go missing actually know where they are. Like it's not a mystery to them, unless they've, they've gotten confused or lost quite quite often, like, people will, you know, leave one environment to go to a different one. And the problem with that is that people don't know where they are. Not that the missing person doesn't know where they is generally. So looking at the issue, like, a person becomes missing because they aren't in the places that they usually are, and people around them have recognized that and have said, actually, this is really concerning. And then to be counted in the statistics, they would need to then make a report with the police or a tracing organization or something. So in essence, missing people get defined because people around them miss them, not because of anything that they've done specifically, which means that certain people will go missing and no one will realize, and that won't get reported. Or some people go missing and the people around them are not that concerned, say, because they've been missing like a lot of times before, and they think, oh, that's just them, that's just normal. So you get a different, like, a disparity of, like, what counts as concerning and then who counts as missing.
Another point I'd like you to comment on, because missing, the way you've explained it then, is the way where the feelings sit within the person, as you've said, who isn't absent, but the person who is, what we would say, is there, is present. And there's also, a common feeling in our society that you can miss people that don't actually exist. So a lady who is unable to have children might miss the child she never had, or you might miss someone who's died. Do you find any correlation between that feeling and then the feeling of actually someone who you think could potentially come back one day?
I think one of the things that came up a lot in my research and in talking to people who have had loved ones go missing is this concept of ambiguous loss. So this is the idea where basically it is like grief. So it's as though someone's died, but you're not really sure about what the nature of that loss is yet. So you could have, for example, if you have like a loved one who has become like terminally ill, so you know that they're going to die, but you don't necessarily know when. Often people will start, in a sense, grieving that loss, even though it's not actually happened yet. And then it happens with missing persons, or I guess if you have a loved one with dementia, say, and they've become quite different as a person, like a different, like you've lost the person that they once were, kind of thing. So that's a difficult form of grief, I think, especially compared to, if you compare it to death, at least, I mean, when someone dies, it's obviously really horrible, but you do have like a ritual for coping with it. You have funerals, you have ways of marking that grief that can be really helpful. But when it comes to missing persons, there's nothing like that. So there's just uncertainty about whether you should be grieving at all, and maybe a lack of support from other people, because it is a less kind of relatable form of grief. And they're feelings that don't really go away because the situation stays essentially the same.
And I think that comes out in the next part of the book, which is, it's almost, the book's divided, I found very interestingly, where it starts off with what a lot of people, at least I did, thought of was, this is what a missing person is. And you have famous cases, Maddie McCann, Azaria Chamberlain. And then as the book goes on, you develop through more complex cases that people might not think of, or I would not have thought of as being cases of missing. But then you explain how that they are. With the famous people, can you talk about two elements of that? One is that there's a very public profile of those missing stories. They saturate the news. But I also, of course, obviously, sitting behind that are the individuals who are affected in the way you've just described. And it's almost as though the public display of those stories is so different from the personal grief of the people who have lost the person. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, definitely. So I guess if a loved one, if one of your loved ones went missing, you'd want the kind of level of media coverage that someone like Madeleine McCann has received and continues to receive. So, I mean, I guess some the basic facts is that she was missing, went missing in Portugal in 2007 when she was 3 years old. And her parents were only meters away, but they were out having dinner with friends. And then there was like this huge publicity campaign in order to try to find any information. A reward fund, it was to the tune of like 2.6 million pounds for any like information about her, and like donors included people like J.K. Rowling and Rupert Murdoch. It was huge, and it was also kind of although like the parents got something out of it in the sense that like obviously this is one of the most high profile missing persons cases ever, but on top of that, the newspapers also got a lot out of it. Whenever she was on the front cover, there was like, I think it was like 30,000 additional copies would be sold.
Wow.
Yeah. So, so in that sense, like this is, you would think like a pretty ideal situation. Like if your child was lost, this kind of coverage is amazing. It's exactly what you'd want. But then it comes, like the narrative kind of changed to start to blame the parents. A Portuguese police inspector actually like quit the police force so that he could write a book in 2008, like to accuse the parents of covering up her death. And there were all these like weird rumors, and all of it has been like debunked, and the parents have received like defamation money and compensation and stuff. But I guess what has happened in that case is that it turned from like, oh, we're all very concerned about this, to we need to blame the parents, because if a child can go missing in these circumstances and every single effort is made to find her and we still can't find her, like what does that say about risk? What does that say about the likelihood that any child could go missing? And I think that kind of fear was behind that condemnation of Madeleine McCann's parents. And then there was no space left in the public really for their grief. And they were just seen as suspicious people rather than as.
I think every example you use in that chapter involves the parents becoming the suspects of the missing person.
Yeah, and I think it is going back to that idea of, like, what does it mean for us if, you know, a dingo can eat your baby, like just out of the blue, or if a girl with, like, quite a lot of socioeconomic privilege and a lot of attention is still missing, and you know it's been a long time, and similar with JoBenet Ramsey, although she's not missing, she was only missing for a few hours, but still those parents were absolutely like just dragged, and I think at least part of that was had to do with coming to terms with the fact that children go missing and it might not be anyone's fault, and that just might be a risk of being alive.
The one turn the book first takes is commenting on how the tragedy of a person who's missing in a comment in something you were talking about a little bit earlier, which is the not knowing aspect of it. And you relay this story of Q Goodwin in New Zealand, who looks as though he may have taken his own life, but I don't think in the end, ultimately, he may have been declared to be dead lawfully, but I'm not sure that there's been actually any body found.
No.
And the point, so I'll be grateful if you'll comment on that story. And one thing in particular is another very interesting point is that the people left behind can some, and it didn't happen in this case, which is what I'd like you to comment on, but the people left behind can almost become trapped in that moment, so they feel they can't leave their house, they can't move somewhere else in case this person turns up one day. How would they ever find them? And it's just such a, you can just sense the claustrophobia of just this your world just collapsing in on you and freezing you at a moment in time.
Yeah, so there has been some research about that. I guess it's almost like a different sense of time that you can have if you're a family member or a friend of a missing person, which is that every day without them, you might feel guilty that you're going on with your life and you still have this mystery, I guess, that you need to solve. So people get into kind of habits of trying to look for the missing person whenever they've, like, they might go out for shopping and they'll be scanning like the supermarket aisles for the person, or they might feel bad about going to see a movie or something because that's 3 hours where you can't be looking. Yeah, there are also examples of people who are like have thought of about moving to a new house or something. But then the danger of that is that if they do that and the missing person decides to come back one day, they might not be that easy to find again. And so, yeah, there's this sense of real stuckness. And I think one of the things I talked to Sarah Godwin about, her son was Q, the boy, the teenager you mentioned. She basically, in order to like get through that like inertia, I suppose, she had to move. She moved back to the UK. So she was in New Zealand and decided to go back to the UK where she was from initially, where, you know, she would get some space from that, which isn't to say, because obviously that's also quite guilt-inducing. That isn't to say that she stopped caring about the case, just that distance really was needed for her to cope with what was going to be the rest of her life.
Yes. And one thing that comes through to me is for the reader of your work who doesn't have a missing person in their life, it seems so easy to judge the conduct of the person who isn't missing. And it's almost as though the person who isn't missing, so in this case, the lady who moved back, who moved to the UK, has to justify why she moved to the UK. It seems it's such a burden of being someone associated with a missing person that you have all these, it's almost as though you have these expectations put upon you as to how you must act.
Yeah, I think from her and from a few other people I spoke to, there was this sense of like, why isn't this case solved yet? Or there can be quite diametrically opposed views, but they all come from sort of the same idea, which is that I can't tolerate the fact that you don't know where your loved one is. So I want to either impose on you an ending, like, oh, you should give up because this person's probably dead, or have you looked in this place or that place, or, you know, have you really like done the job good enough, that kind of thing. Or I guess the alternative is that the conversation just gets shut down. People can get really isolated from friends and stuff, who don't really want to talk about it at all.
Gosh. Another scenario that comes up is where two parents have a child and one parent removes the child from the legal jurisdiction into another jurisdiction, and the person left behind in the place where they all used to be can sometimes not be able to get back to their child.
Yeah. So in that case, so with child abduction, I think I mean, one thing that's probably like a point that's probably worth making is that a lot of people think of child abduction as like a stranger taking a child away, just kind of randomly. But in most cases, children are abducted by a family member or someone they know. And quite often it's one of their parents. So in this case, it was the child's father abducted him without. So he did have joint custody of the child, but they weren't allowed to take the child out of the country without the permission of the other. So, yeah, and then that became a real problem. So the parent left behind the mother. She basically had to wait until the father had custody over like a holiday, over like a school holiday, and then she had to wait until the end of the school holidays before she could make a police complaint, because technically he would have been able to he could have gone on holiday or something. So then she had to go through like a mediator who ended up being able to contact the father, who was in Portugal. And then it just became like a really big 5 month long kind of legal proceed. It was almost like civil proceedings to get the sum back. And she was able to contact him like on the telephone and that kind of thing over the time. But it's really difficult. And especially when you have the feeling, which is what happened in this case, that the father wasn't really taking the son in order because he thought that that would be good for the son's welfare or anything. It was because the son was really important to her, and it was a way to assert control over her. And then so the concern was that he would be taken even further away again, and it would be even harder to recover him.
Yes, and one point that you comment on, and I would like to know what your research found out about this, is that when the child in that case did go back to Belgium, I think it was,
yep,
the one important point was that the father isn't arrested for a crime, it's a civil matter,
yep,
under the law. And I imagine that so that there's no disincentive for the father to return or the parent to return, because they're not going to get thrown in jail. So it's almost a sort of mercy law, almost, or a way of it just has to happen like that. Is that approach typical, that it wouldn't be, that you would not be charged with a crime?
I'm not actually sure. I guess that's a legal question, and I think it would depend on the jurisdiction. What generally happens is that under these laws, it can be quite different. So in this situation, it turned out quite well. But what can happen is that, say, a woman fleeing a domestic violence situation will take her children to her country of origin, and then this proceeding would be made against her, and then that would then introduce all these other issues around like safety and that kind of thing. So I think these laws are probably good. I think they could be probably strengthened and to be more tailored to like what kind of situations do we actually want to protect children from, and what situations can we see that maybe it is in the child's best interest to be maybe not taken abroad, but to be removed from a situation like domestic violence. I think it's really complicated, and I don't know if international legal instruments are particularly good with interpersonal relationships, because we've got a massive infrastructure trying to tell individual people what to do, and obviously it becomes so nuanced and stuff, but it's hard to say what would be effective.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes. Another aspect you draw out is because a missing someone who's missing for those who are left behind is such a stressful, such an emotionally draining experience, it does give rise to the ability for humans to be cruel. And taking a child across a border where there's no ability for the person to easily get the child back could be used as a trick, as to punish or to harm the person who's left behind. So a father might take a child, the mother suffers, and it's done to make the mother suffer, not necessarily for the best interests of the child, where domestic violence could be the exact opposite situation. And you also refer to these terrible incidents where someone's missing and people will ring up and say, "Oh, we've found the person. And like a trick." And it just sounds horrendous. How would the family cope with that sort of prank?
Yeah, so the hoaxes are just they're really difficult to comprehend. So this happened to two different people who I interviewed, where they asked for the public for information. And set up a phone number, and someone has called that phone number and has just said either horrible things or has just probably made up a story. So it happened to Sarah with her son Q, where the caller was a young woman, I think, and she was saying that she had a baby with this missing person, and it just became horrifying for the family. It's because you honestly don't know what's happened to this person. And one of the things that kind of happens when a person goes missing is that you do find out bits of information about them that you might not have known. It wasn't a big theme in the among the people I spoke to, but in the research, you might find out that someone was addicted to drugs or had relationships that you didn't realize that they'd had, and this sort of thing. So one of the things that those sorts of hoaxes do is they completely undermine your understanding of that person. And they really do have to be taken seriously, because you don't know how to easily distinguish between information and just stuff that's been made up, because you've got this whole doubt over the entire situation.
Another tragic circumstance concerns runaways. And runaways are often, to me at least, thought of as being a sort of romantic notion of someone running off and life isn't that great, off into the green fields. But the stories that your research turned up concern things like children being abused and having to flee, or houses with lots of drug use in them, or one parent inflicted domestic violence on the other. And then, even worse almost, the person who runs away might not actually be able to stay runaway, because running away is expensive. You've got to live. So they may even have to go back to the place they fled from and expose themselves again to what was happening. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so I kind of had a romantic notion of runaways as well. And I think that another notion that exists about runaways is that it's just like a kid throwing a tantrum. Like, they're just not getting their way at home, so they're just running away to, like, change that because they're just fed up or whatever. But so there are quite a lot of studies about runaways. There was one US study that is around 38% of runaways have been physically abused at home, and about 10% have been verbally abused at home. So often they're running away from really difficult circumstances. And one of the problems is for police, say, when they find someone who's in this situation and bring them back to their home, they've not really resolved the problem. Like, the reason why they ran away in the first place is still there. So what can happen is that you get people running away multiple times. And so an investigator, like a missing persons investigator I spoke to, knew of someone who'd run away from home over 100 times, which is, like, just very dramatic. And it's a big use of police resources. But I think more importantly, it really speaks to, like, the high level of distress that runaways can be under.
Mm. Another category you raise are refugees and people who go missing through refugees, be it through war or whatever the case might be. I'd like to ask you how refugees fit into the frame of missing people. And then another point you also explain is the way in which refugees are portrayed in the public imagination through the media also has a big impact on this part of the missing person universe.
Yeah, sure. So basically, whenever people are having to leave their home, it makes them incredibly vulnerable to going missing. So, if you just have to relocate from one place to another relatively quickly, in that time, people do go missing. And then on top of that, some of the issues that can occur in, like, migration situations is where minors are traveling. Say, I was looking at the refugee crisis in Europe. So when minors are traveling into Europe without any parents, either because they don't have it or have them, or more commonly just because their parents were not accompanying them. And then in that case, what can happen is that they can go missing from refugee centres and facilities that are intended to keep them safe while they get processed and this sort of thing. So what can happen, like, the reasons why they go missing from those places are pretty complex, and there's probably multiple reasons. So there's the potential that they're being abducted. There's also the potential that they want to go to a different country, or they within the EU, and they don't quite understand, like, why they're in the reception center, and they might not have had have very good communications to them in languages that they understand. So it can become quite messy in terms of missing persons very quickly. And, like, some of the statistics around unaccompanied minors, so in 2016, Europol was estimating that there was around 10,000 missing unaccompanied minors in Europe, but the charity I spoke to thought it was much higher than that, probably because it's underreported. So, it becomes a huge issue.
Yes, and with underreporting, that comes up as well.
Yeah.
What is underreporting, and what can be done to better that situation?
Yeah, so underreporting, it basically happens when, there'll be a certain number of missing persons cases, but not all of them get acknowledged or recognised as missing persons cases, and so it underestimates just the number of missing persons. So it's pretty common, just because people will go missing but no one will have realized, or or people have decided not to report it, and then their numbers are artificially low, which, given that, because the missing persons figures are quite high, given that they're probably an underestimate, it is like quite a lot of people going missing. So the latest figure in Australia is the 38,000 missing persons reports a year. But you can probably, you could pretty safely assume that it's actually a bit higher than that.
Mm. And with in Australia at least, if a person goes missing and it's reported, are you talking about being reported to the police services in various states?
Yeah, so usually it's the police reporting. There are other ways people can report someone is missing. I think like the Red Cross tracing service and that kind of thing, but that would be more for that wouldn't be for a run-of-the-mill case. That would be like if you're trying to track someone like internationally or something. So yes, predominantly from police reports. Yeah.
And how that seems to be an incredible amount of work on a police force who's primary job, I imagine, isn't considered to be finding missing people, but doing more direct community policing. How is there a better way to actually deal with missing people than through the police services, do you think?
Yeah, so this is something that came up, especially when I was speaking to the missing persons investigator, Charlie. He made the point, and which I agree with, a lot of the issues that come up, a lot of the reasons why people go missing actually are not well dealt with by police. They just aren't that kind of a profession. So if you have someone who's going missing frequently because they're incredibly distressed, say they're in an abusive situation, or they might have a mental health condition or that kind of thing, it's a bit strange that the police are the ones who are often first responding to that kind of situation rather than psychological services or other social services. So I think one of the best ways to prevent so much of police time being used on missing persons is to prevent some of the reasons why people go missing in the first place. And often that is like a lack of social supports. And in other countries, like in Europe and stuff, one of the things that can happen is, especially with younger people, after they've gone missing, they get, I guess, case managed. They get assigned like a social worker or similar who follows up with them. And you can't just go missing without anyone like asking why, or like without trying to integrate you with social services or with counseling services or that kind of thing. So I think those two things would make a big difference.
And the purpose of trying to find out why the person went missing, that is preventative for the future. Is that the main reason for that?
Yeah. If you figure out why the person went missing, and hopefully it's possible to address that cause, especially if it is a difficult situation, like a difficult living situation, or maybe just not enough support or that kind of thing.
Mm. The book goes into the tragic Australian event of the stolen generations of the Indigenous people in Australia. And the point made, I think some of the points that, and I'd like you to comment on this, is it's not just simply the physical removal of a child from their parents, and it's not even in these types of cases, it's much more serious also than even, because even if the child is, even if you get the parents out of the picture and say, imagine you have the legitimate basis to say, we don't care about their parents and we're going to put this child into a really good home, that still does matter, even if that was all agreed as being good. I don't know why someone would think that, but for argument's sake, the damage goes much deeper than that. I think one of the points you make is you're taking away the person's, their cultural personhood, their very culture, and all their spirit and their practices and all that sort of thing. It's such a serious, serious thing that's happening. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I think This is a point I feel like came up in a lot of different cases, but it's really emphasized, I think, with the Stolen Generations cases, because like it is one thing to take a person away from like their family, who, you know, it's everything they know, and then it's also on top of that is the additional wounds of isolating them from their cultural heritage, isolating them from their language, isolating them from spirituality and their, I guess, even sense of meaning. And that sense of meaning is very, like, it's ancestral. It goes so far back. It's so fundamental to First Nations cultures, that it's a travesty. There's not really enough words for it. It's a really frightening practice, and it's frightening to me that there are suggestions that there's sort of like an ongoing removal of Indigenous children. I think in 2012 there was the stat, which was astounding, that there was $80 million spent on surveillance and removal of First Nations children, and only $500,000 spent on actually supporting families in poverty. That was in the Northern Territory. And then there's also New South Wales reviews of child protection of First Nations children, and things like protection workers giving misleading evidence in court leading to removal of a child, omitting like positive information about what the parents are doing well, which is like against their own departmental rules. And this sort of like cases of separating twins from each other, this sort of thing. It's quite frightening.
And another point you make in this part of the book concerns cognitive dissonance, and you reflect on how in South Africa apartheid was a regime that was considered horrible for people in Australia, but at the same time there were the whole Stolen Generations that back in those days weren't in the public, didn't have the public profile they might have now at all. It's just there are things that exist within our own cultures that might be abhorrent, and they're ignored by taking on these issues that happen in other countries and don't actually affect the people where the communities they live in.
Yeah, I think a lot of people find that it is easier to criticize other people or to identify problems when it's a system that you're not part of. Like you can look at apartheid and go, that's terrible. I think it becomes more challenging for people for a multitude of reasons to look at their own culture and say, like, this is a problem also, like this is actually like just as bad or worse even. I guess that means on the bright side that like people do understand like racism, or like certain that governments have the capacity to enact incredibly racist legislation. And if we're able to like apply that to our own understanding of our own culture and our own society, that would be really useful.
Yes. You then have a section in the book on cults. And one question before I move into some of the details on cults, you make a decision, and you refer to it in the book about using the term cults rather than new religious movements.
Yeah, so this was a complicated question for me. Generally, so scholars of new religious movements prefer that terminology because the word cult can really send the signal that just like this is a fringe movement, like this isn't a very popular belief system, therefore it's got problems, or therefore it has dynamics that are abusive, or that people get brainwashed into them. I decided to use the word cults just because this was the word that people who have had experiences in these circumstances use that word. And I think that they would probably be they have expertise in this, that their lived experience is worth acknowledging. And I think that what they were pointing to when they called these organizations cults was that, I guess, a disingenuousness about what they believed. And so you basically have to join, and then you have to be a member for a long time before you actually understand the true nature of what the actual movement is all about, which kind of that dishonesty, I think, was part of the reason why they thought of it as a cult rather than like a legitimate religion that is just unusual.
And why do you categorize someone in a cult as being missing, in the sense that the family might know exactly where the person is? They're off in country X with this particular cult, so they're not missing in the sense of, and they might be an adult, they're not missing in the sense of being sort of lost. How do they factor into being missing?
Yeah, I think that is ambiguous. And the case I was looking at, which I do think of ultimately as a missing persons case, was I was speaking to a friend of someone who had joined one of these groups who had basically he was a Korean originally, living in New Zealand, but he'd gone back to Korea, and he found one of these groups, and it was really interesting to him, and he decided that he would, stay on. And eventually his parents kind of said, like, if you don't come back, we'll stop paying you, so you won't actually have enough money to live. So then he had to go back to New Zealand, and then this group, members of it, funded his return back to Korea, and from then he was completely dependent on the group. So he needed it, obviously they funded his return journey to Korea, but also funded his food and living arrangements and everything. And they had certain rules about when he could go out, when he couldn't. So, and then in all this time, he got really isolated from the people in his life, because they were like, this is not right. This is, you're being brainwashed, or this sort of language. But the young man I spoke to was the only friend that still talked to him. So they still knew where he was, but there was this sense that, is this like part of his free will, or is there something about this group that is, I guess, exposing like certain vulnerabilities and kind of forcing him into a situation where he's not acting the way he ordinarily would if he had his full capacities, if he could think about the situation from the outside? And I think, like, my view is that people who join these groups are, they're not brainwashed per se. It's not really possible to be brainwashed, but it is really hard, I think, to think about it from a broader view, or like when you're in the middle of the situation. And yeah, and then it does get really, it does get ambiguous. Like, are they missing, or are they just making a choice that is not choices that we would necessarily endorse, but maybe they should be allowed to make it? I one of the ways that I thought about it was that he wasn't abducted. The cult or the group didn't abduct him. He chose to be there. But at the same time, there was something happening that was like a bit abusive and a bit of a weird use of power that wasn't quite right. And that I think we can think of it in terms of a missing persons scenario, in the sense that It led to a lot of ambiguity for his parents, for his friends, who weren't sure if they'd ever see him again, and didn't feel comfortable with just doing nothing and just letting him be part of this group.
Now, just a couple more questions, Erin. You've been very generous with your time.
Oh, no worries.
There were a few cases when I was going through the book that I wanted to ask you about. They're almost atypical cases, and how would you classify these? Before I want to also then reflect again on the opening sentence, to be missing, you must be missed. So there are situations where the examples which I was thinking of were someone who's in prison, someone who has dementia, maybe a kid who's in a boarding school, who to the people left behind, they are missing. They are missing them, but they're not missing people in the sense of the traditionally understand the concept. How would you deal with categories like that?
I think that, they're not missing persons per se, but I think some of the stuff that I've been talking about in terms of ambiguous loss or in terms of just the way relationships work means that there's like quite a lot of crossover, I think. So I think one of the ways that you can think about relationships is that say a family member, say you're like a mother, let's say. So obviously like if she's not there, you miss her because you like her, you love her, you enjoy having her around. But on top of that, she will probably play certain roles in your life. She'll do certain things for you, you'll do certain things for her. And in that way, you both like are interdependent on each other, and you both contribute to each other's understanding of yourselves. And I think when someone isn't around, even if you know why, and even if it's possible to contact them now and then, it's really tough, I think. And it has to do with the fact that you're missing this chunk of your life when you're missing someone really close to you.
It's almost the way in which I imagine mediums can get their market going, because people miss people, and there can be such a strong desire to find the person you miss.
Yeah, I didn't really look into mediums and that kind of thing, but it is a bit of a cottage industry, I think, particularly in the US. I mean, I don't want to speculate on like what mediums think about their own job, but I think it is quite it's going to be quite salient to people, like this idea that you can communicate to someone who's not there, and who you like really depend on for who you are, and like maybe when they were around, like how your day-to-day life goes. And I think it is very easy to exploit that, which is really troubling, but it does really attest to the power of the ties we have. I think we might not always acknowledge like just how important communities, or like especially our strong like family and friend, like close friends, really are.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, Erin. It's been a very enjoyable discussion. As I say, when you read your book, it just, so many ideas, you just think how complicated this idea of being missing is. It's just not straightforward.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Thanks.
And could you let us know what you are working on now? What's your next project?
Well, so I want to work on another book. I have not started. So I guess we'll see what the next project is. I do freelance articles every now and then. So just working on various ideas as they kind of come up. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Sounds very free, very enjoyable. So I wish you all the best with that.
Thanks.
And also all the best with the book. The book is called The Missing Among Us, Stories of Missing Persons and Those Left Behind by Erin Stewart. It's available now in bookstores on through online booksellers as well. Very interesting book, and thank you very much, Erin, for your time.
Thank you.